lectures, I realize I say so a lot. So we're doing this. So we're doing that. So I'm trying to stay away from that. And of course,
So here, so.
Welcome to Scenarios for Tomorrow, a podcast where we turn tomorrow's headlines into today's thought experiments. This first series includes conversations with the authors of our latest book, Improving and Enhancing Scenario Planning, Futures Thinking Volume, from Edward Elgar Publishing. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Crawford, and throughout this first series, you'll hear from my guests the numerous global techniques for practicing and advancing scenario planning. Enjoy. Yeah.
Shardul Fudnis is an associate professor of operations and supply chain management at the Asian School of Business in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Shardul explores the intersection of supply chains and strategic management, specifically how scenario planning influences the adaptability of supply chain configurations and how organizations create value by orchestrating supply chain operations. His 2022 book, Strategic Planning for Dynamic Supply Chains, Preparing for Uncertainty Using Scenarios, describes firsthand accounts of applications of scenario planning for strategic supply chain planning in three in-depth cases involving businesses and government planning agencies. He received the 2015 Jurantani Rising Star Award from the Industry Studies Association for his research in apparel supply chains. Welcome, Shardul.
Thank you, Megan, and thanks for that wonderful introduction.
Yes, well, I honestly enjoyed being able to read your book. What was it about? I think it was 2 years ago, and getting
Almost
a chance
3 years
to write.
Ago, yes.
Yeah, getting a chance to write a reply for it. That was really exciting because I've never worked scenario planning and supply chain together, but they what we'll be talking about today, how well they go together.
Absolutely. Yep. And you wrote the review for that as well. It was a very nice review that came out in, I think, Futures and Foresight Science, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, again, a really great one. Everybody should read both of them. But it's great to finally get a chance to sit down with you one-on-one, because I think the bulk of our chats for years have been relegated to emails and possibly just one conference that we saw each other in passing. I'm not sure if we've even made the same conferences for years, which seems quite extraordinary, doesn't it, given the size of our field?
Exactly. Yeah.
So
very,
here
very
we
small
are.
Community. I mean, seems like the people whose papers we read, we kind of know most of those people. And no, many of those people I haven't even met in person, especially since we have been living in Kuala Lumpur for almost 10 years. And the community seems to be very much focused heavily in Europe, I would say, right? Like where you are and parts of the United States, but not so much in Asia, actually.
Yeah. And we'll be talking about that a little bit, which is why I was really glad that you joined our book. Your perspectives were something I really, really wanted to get into this particular book. So now we finally get to deep dive right into our little understood world of scenario planning and foresight science, and we get to do it at our own pace, which is nice. So as mentioned in the introduction, we've just published a book together about scenario planning in the 21st century. And it was nearly exactly 2 years in the making. In fact, I think our first interview together on this was February 2 years ago, 2023.
Oh, wow. 2 years
ago. Right? I was looking into that. And today, at the quarter century mark, 2025, we're here to talk a bit about our joint work, but particularly your chapter. We understand that not all of our listeners are familiar with scenario planning, though many may have heard more about it since the pandemic, when it got when our jobs got really popular. Mm-hmm. And one of the motivations to this podcast is to bring our world of futures and foresight science outside the walls of academia, where within the language is very closely controlled for understandable reasons. That's just the nature of science communication. And knowledge is not as easy to access as we generally wish it to be. So mm-hmm. we're here to have a chat with the public.
That's great. That's great. I think it is really something very important thing to do to bring this, you know, really critical process of scenario planning, right? And as I think about it, as we talk about it, it seems that scenario planning is getting even more and more important for the world that we live in. Now, we are swimming in all kinds of uncertainties these days, right? Think about the trade wars and the tariffs that are issues that are going on, the geopolitical tensions, but also, you know, just even beyond that, the whole thing with AI, which, you know, your book is so timely, Scenario Planning for the 21st Century. We don't understand how it's going to affect organizations or even more broadly society. And that's where scenario planning can be really helpful. And also the another thing about the net zero, the whole environmental sustainability aspect. Companies are struggling to kind of embark on the net zero journey successfully. And one of the biggest things there are stumbling blocks is really the uncertainty. And they're struggling to figure out how to make kind of long-term investment decisions under that uncertainty. So it is absolutely the perfect timing for you and Josh to come up with this book. And I think it's very timely that we are doing this podcast as well.
Great. Well, I'm glad you and I agree. So you touched upon a lot of points there that I really, really wanted to get into. And some of them being what we even mean by uncertainty. It's a word thrown around a lot like innovation. And everybody has an opinion on what it means. And every business has a specific focus on a realm of uncertainty or innovation, as it were. And so, yeah, it would be cool to see if we can, your chapter in particular gives some very concrete examples of this. And let me go ahead and introduce your chapter. Your contribution to this book was titled, or is titled, Evaluating Effects of Scenario Planning, Lessons from Medical Research. Your chapter is the only one that brings in the medical field as a focus for the practice of scenario planning. So I wanted to open with that. In particular, let's just start with what motivated you to explore the effects of scenario planning through the lens of medical research methodologies?
Okay, so I think it is worth giving some background. So I'm an engineer. So when I started applying scenario planning in the context of supply chain strategy and supply chain management, my orientation was not so much descriptive to see how this actually works in the companies that applied, but it was a fairly strong prescriptive orientation to say, look, the executives, supply chain executives specifically, that we are dealing with, that we are working with, are dealing with some extremely challenging situations. They are focused on a day-to-day job, but they also have to think about what kind of, let's say, supply chain infrastructure. And what I mean by that is factories, distribution network, distribution centers, investing in a fleet of vehicles, making long-term partnerships with suppliers, and so on and so forth. These decisions often go, you know, beyond your few quarters. They last, now you have to think about next 5 years, 10 years. In some projects that we have done for freight infrastructure, now you even have to think about next 30 years. So that's the kind of application context I was working with. And when we go in that context, it is a prescriptive orientation in the sense that you are bringing in scenario planning as a decision-making aid, something that's going to help you overcome the limitations that you currently have, the limitations of existing decision-making processes. So by nature, we need to show that it actually works. So that was kind of a motivation that to really see, is it beneficial to use scenario planning? So that was one question that I had during my doctoral studies. And in my dissertation, I have one paper that does use field experiments to answer that question partly. But also,
yeah.
The second thing is that,
I was just thinking, I was going to say, it's that is a very, very real and salient issue in the field of scenario planning is it effective? If it is, how do we show that it's effective? And I think that was the entrance for a lot of us into our doctoral study. So that's it, really fascinating to find out that you had the same motivation, considering we entered the field very differently and in very different places, but we had the same motivation there and others in our field as well. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So when you think about scenario planning, there are some questions that sometimes they seem, maybe not everybody thinks about them. So just to give you some examples, let's just say if you're thinking for the long term and there is kind of uncertainty in the sense that you cannot really predict or you cannot really foresee how things might evolve in the future, but the investments that you're making today, let's say you're deciding to build a factory and you want to know, should I build that factory in the United States or Canada or Mexico, or should I build it in Asia, or should I not even build a factory at all, but kind of outsource my production to a contract manufacturer? But when you're making decisions of that nature, you have to think about next 5-10 years, because if I start building a factory, it's going to take a couple of years to build it. And once you build it, you're not going to close it down, say 6 months later, thinking that, oops, I made a mistake in deciding to build this factory. You're going to operate it for 3-5 years. So you have to think about that long-term planning horizon. And that's why we bring in scenario planning, right? But then you think about it in terms of application areas. So is this process of scenario planning, is it equally useful for a new startup that's thinking about next 2 to 3 years, versus a multinational corporation that could be using scenario planning for its corporate strategy or operations or supply chain strategy, which might have a planning horizon of 5, 7, or 10 years? Or let's say a freight infrastructure investment, such as the Department of Transportation. And when they're building highways and investing in ports and rail lines and so on, they're thinking 20, 30 years out. So is it the same process? Is it the same process equally useful? Does context matter? That's number one. Second, if it is, then should you create the scenarios and apply them in the same way in all three cases? Or should there be any variations? Then another thing that we talk about is, it's not a one-time use of scenarios, but you want to use it on an ongoing basis. So what are the pros and cons of that? And if you want to use it on an ongoing basis, how frequently should you use it? Should you use it every 3 months, once a year, once a month? What's the right frequency? And then we can, especially in my field where in operations and supply chain management, the executives are often consumed by issues of the short-term nature. Did we meet this monthly target for the target for this month? Are we meeting the quarterly target? And if the same executives are thinking using scenarios that go 5 or 10 years out, does that hinder their ability to think for the short term, which is also equally important, right? So this, and then there is the whole emergence of AI in last 2 or 3 years, when we are thinking what decisions could be left to AI and what could be made by executives using tools like scenario planning. So there are all these questions, and I don't think in our field we have a very scientifically valid answer to these questions, right? And that's where the question of this evaluation comes in, is how should you answer these questions? How should we answer these questions? What are the different methods for doing that? And that was the whole motivation behind my doctoral research, as well as your research, as you said. And the reason for, and to kind of make the long story short, the reason for bringing medicine is that when I was during my doctoral studies, I had a professor from mechanical engineering, Dan Fry, at MIT. He was on my doctoral committee, and he had written a paper that borrowed medical research methods for evaluating design methods with a very similar prescriptive orientation. And that kind of motivated this. And I saw, look, there are parallels between medicine and scenario planning. at least in my application, scenario planning is prescriptive, just like medicine. Just like in medicine, you cannot just try any unproven treatment on a human being, or there is a very systematic way for doing that. No, in scenario planning, we cannot just go and test these things on a corporation because there are some huge implications for the success or the failure of this method. So there are ethical issues that are common to both medicine and scenario planning. It's a prescriptive orientation. And that's why I think borrowing the ideas from medicine, which has a very established way of evaluating new treatments, we can learn from that in scenario planning. And that's what this chapter tries to do.
Okay. So yeah, a lot of people, when they first saw this, thought it was the other way around. It was using scenario planning to advance medical questions, problems, you know, risk and things like that. But you're saying it was the other way around. It was learning from a well-established and robust system that is medicine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what we do in this book, is that we talk about, we kind of motivate the need for learning from medicine and kind of justify why we can do that. But then we talk about medical research methods first. And so in medicine, there are about 13 methods that we cover in this book book chapter. And they fall in kind of four different categories. So they go from really basic fundamental research to there are clinical trials, then there are observational studies, and then there is epidemiological studies, right? And then we say, okay, how does medicine practice these different kinds of research methods to evaluate new medical treatments? And then we kind of analogously say, okay, what can we learn from that for scenario planning? And how can we design research methods analogously by learning from medical research methods?
Okay. Well, what are some of the answers you found or observations?
Okay. So maybe it will be useful just to give a very brief overview of medical research methods, because not
yes.
everybody may be familiar with it. So
I'm not familiar.
I mean, neither was I until I started kind of looking into this angle. And as I got deeper into it, I was actually quite impressed by how methodical the whole process is. It all starts with, say, basic or fundamental research. And you can think about there are about four different categories of basic research. So there's the theoretical research, right, when you are looking at the fundamental sciences like biology, microbiology, and so on, and you're using the theoretical knowledge to develop new hypotheses. Okay, so that's kind of one thing. Second after that is what is called in vitro studies. So that's where researchers will take samples of cells and tissues and try things on that. So if there is a new molecule that they want to try out, they can just try in a test tube. That's why it is in vitro, right? So it's a very small scale. But what works for at the tissue or cell or tissue level may not work for the whole entire animal. So then the third level is called in vivo studies, where medicine uses animal models, right? Because now you are not dealing with just one kind of cell, but now about 400 different types of cells, different types of tissues, and so on, and see how this treatment works in the whole body. And then there is lastly computer modeling, which is called in silico studies, right? So computer modeling, simulation, and so on. So that is all kind of the theoretical research. You can establish causality because you are working in a very controlled environment. But to establish kind of external validity is difficult because you're still in the lab. So the second group of medical studies is what is known as clinical trials. And some of these are done before a treatment is approved and released. And there's kind of one that is done afterwards. So it starts with phase one, where you're not even working with patients or people who are suffering from a condition, but you are working with healthy adults. And you're just trying to see what is the right dosage, what is a safe dosage, a very small group of healthy individuals. Once it passes that stage, then you go to the medicine goes to the second phase of clinical trial. And you're working with a small group of people who are living with that condition. And you find out, okay, is this effective? Does it really help these people? And if that passes, then you go to the third stage of clinical trials when you're looking at a much larger study. And this is where you might have a control group, you will have a double-blind study and so on. And what medicine is trying to decide here is this new treatment just as safe and just as effective as the current alternative that we have? And if it passes, then the drug gets released. But then there's stage four clinical trial, which is you don't stop there. So they will continue evaluating to see how is this drug working in the longer term, not just in a few weeks that you had for these phase one, two, or three clinical trials. Right, so it's a very methodical way of clinical trials. And then there are observational studies. So observational studies come in when you cannot prescribe something. It could be too dangerous, not ethical to prescribe this treatment, or it could be, let's say, if you want to see the effect of living near a chemical plant. You cannot ask people to go live near a chemical plant, right? But you are using secondary data kind of retrospectively to see how does it affect who people who lived near this chemical plant, or what was the effect of radiation or having lead in the paint and things like that, right? So it's kind of the secondary data retrospective studies, which is observational. And there's a fourth category of study that is called epidemiological. And even then, there are about three or four categories. So one is just ecological studies, where they find the medical researchers are trying to see how prevalent is a certain condition among a certain group of people, maybe by ethnicity, by their geography, and so on. Okay, it's just observational. Now, you're not looking at any individuals. Kind of, you're looking at kind of a large aggregate group of people. Then there are cross-sectional studies, which are similar to ecological, but you also collect some individual level data to see, do any individual attributes affect this? Then there are case control. Then you say, okay, well, let's take a group of, you know, when you're choosing people based on the dependent variable, right? So you're saying, okay, look, there's a group of people who are suffering from a medical condition. Let's choose a control group who do not have that condition. And let's look backwards and see what independent variables might affect or might predict why this control group has a condition, or sorry, the treatment, or rather the suffering group or the patients have this condition, but control group doesn't. And lastly, there are cohort studies where you study over long term, that just longitudinally. And the most, probably one of the most famous examples of cohort studies is the British smoker study, which we mentioned in this book as well, the book chapter as well, is that longitudinally, starting from 1951, they studied doctors who were smokers versus non-smokers. And they looked at the fatality rate, how it varied. And that was a very convincing proof that smoking actually is not good for you. So there is this whole array of research methods to understand, evaluate different medical treatments, understand diseases, and so on. So now we borrow from that and say, okay, can we learn from this and design interventions, let's say research to understand how scenario planning affects these different, how the practice of scenario planning influences the decision process itself, the individual judgment, team judgment, outcomes, and things like that. So what we have done in this chapter is we talk about the scenario planning research methods, but also I wanted to see how once I looked at, okay, 13 medical research methods, then there are 13 analogous scenario planning research methods. And I want to see how widely have these been studied in our literature. And it is, no, it's actually, no, there are studies that fall in these different buckets. Now, and those are mentioned in the book chapter. There are also a few of these research methods for which we don't have any studies. So it kind of, the book chapter opens up and says, look, there's a vast field of scenario planning which we can evaluate using a variety of methods. For some, there's already an established kind of precedence and we have things that we can build on. But there are some other areas that are completely, you know, it's like Wild West, nobody has ventured there. And those mm-hmm. could be great opportunities for new researchers to explore.
Yeah, and that's something I think is what brought possibly all of us into the world of futures and foresight more broadly, but scenario planning specifically is we're the lucky few as sort of at the edge of the field. Some people use the term vanguard, if you will, but I think we're a bit late for that one. That would have been more in the 50s when this was being scenario planning was being spearheaded by Herman Kahn and the early crew. But yeah, there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of gaps in knowledge. And sometimes people think it's because there's no interest, but I have a feeling, and I did at the start, and I remain with this feeling that it just hasn't been enough time and enough people. Like it just takes time for people to stand up and say, oh yeah, I have that question. Let's look into it, as you have done with this, with the information that you shared for this chapter. So one thing I took from what you were saying was that medical research is very structured, and understandably so, because we're talking about people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about severe, not in a bad way, but just severe concerns of ethicality, you know, ethical practice. And as we always should, when we're looking at treatments that could help or harm human life, or just life in general. But as well with that, it sounds like it's what we call an iterative process, where one thing is tested, the next thing that's tested is built off of the knowledge of that. And sometimes they go back because of the new discoveries they find. It's like, okay, we need to step back and test this again. Is that one of the methods or the methodology that you were looking at to support scenario planning use and research?
Absolutely, yeah. Because any research method has, no, it has some strengths, it has some limitations, right? And in medicine, that is understood that if you're using, let's say if you're conducting, let's say in vitro or in vivo studies, let's say with animal models, the external validity of those models is going to be questionable, right? Because you're working on mice per se, not human beings, right? But that is still valuable. What you're learning from those animal models, that knowledge is valuable. Same thing we have to understand in the scenario planning literature as well. Yes, so for example, if I'm doing experiments with, say, MBA students, of course, the decisions that are made by MBA students in using a particular case in a course, in a one semester long course, it would be difficult to, it will be difficult to, no, so their external validity of those decisions would be questionable for real world decisions, right?
And just for our listeners who aren't in academia, and especially experimentation, would you take a second to tell us what you mean by external validity?
Yeah, great. Okay, so thanks. I'm glad you asked that because sometimes we take these terms for granted, right?
I do.
Yeah, so no, we kind of use these terms all the time, but they may not
be common.
Because
it's part of our profession, right? It's something Absolutely. We have to constantly acknowledge in everything we write when it comes to studies, right? And yeah. and gathering data. So I'll pass the mic back to you.
Okay. I'm glad you asked that, Megan. So external validity is, let's say we conduct a study. Let's say we are testing the effect of scenario planning's use on how students choose between, say, options 1, 2, and 3, let's just say, hypothetically. And we find out that students who use scenario planning opted for option 3, which is a more flexible investment in a certain project and so on, versus students who did not use scenario planning went for, say, option one, which is a very concrete, rigid investment. Once you invest, you cannot deviate from that. Let's just say we find that. Now, external validity means what we have seen in this classroom project, classroom experiment, rather, would that work in the real world as well? So, in other words, can we claim that by using scenario planning, a real-world decision maker, and often these decisions are made by executives who are very senior, have now a couple of decades or maybe even more experience, would they behave the same way, or would the scenario planning have the same effect on their decisions as what we saw in the classroom with MBA students or even undergraduate cases? So that's the question of external validity. Can we take the findings from our small setting and say they apply in the real world setting of corporations and say public sector organizations and so on?
You mentioned in there that the causal effects, often every time in scenario planning practice, as well as medical practice, we're looking for causal relationships. Did this thing change something in the business environment, change something in the human's biological system? Did it change something within the makeup of the bacteria, the drug, whatever we're working with? But from what you've discovered in your work, particularly, you know, with this, what you shared in the chapter, what are some of the biggest barriers that you found to conducting rigorous empirical, which means evidence gathering studies in our field?
I think the biggest challenge in our field is getting access to a setting, right? Working with an organization that is willing to work with you, but also is willing to kind of allow you to maybe do controlled experimentation in a very controlled manner, but just willing to do that, right? As opposed to just saying, okay, create scenarios and then we can start using them. Kind of that experimentation part where we can vary things. Okay, maybe the way we create scenarios, maybe the way we apply scenarios, but by creating variation, we can see which one works better, right? Which is more effective, or if it is not, right? But that is challenging. And to your earlier point, Megan, when you mentioned that a lot of the work in our field in scenario planning has been observational, you're absolutely spot on, right? So there are four kind of broad categories of medical research methods that I mentioned. You have the theoretical research, then there are the clinical trials that we know very popular, everybody knows about them, or they are in the news, we hear about them. Then there are observational studies, and then there is epidemiological, right? Okay, so kind of more retrospective or could be prospective studies as well. But if you look at some of the classic works in scenario planning, the works of Pierre Walk, for example, and what we learn from use of scenario planning at Shell, right? These are perfect examples of observational studies. We know what happened, or we have read about what happened, and based on that, we believe that scenario planning is very useful. There are other cases of, say, UPS, for example. There's a very famous Harvard Business Review case about UPS's use of scenario planning. And I use that in my courses because it is scenario planning and UPS is a supply chain company. So it's a perfect combination for my course. But these are observational studies. They are useful. They are certainly valuable because they tell us that, look, this method, scenario planning, can actually be quite useful. It can help companies get ahead of their competitors. What I say in this chapter is that it is great, those studies are valuable, but we shouldn't restrict ourselves just to the observational studies. We also need to do theoretical research. We need to be inspired by the way clinical trials are conducted and use analogous methods for testing scenario planning. We can even do even epidemiological studies, right?
Yeah, I think, and understandably so, I think that is something not really well understood the value of bringing a facilitator on who understands research methods, because it's not that this is a research project. You know, it's not like we are even going to write a paper from our consultings often. It's that we have this background that helps us understand how to evidence our work, how to lay out the game plan, you know, in a very project management kind of way, but with that research panache to it, if you will, where we are because in research, we constantly have to think about and justify before we're even allowed to step into our project, what we're looking for, how we're going to try to find it. We don't know if we're going to find it or not, right? Mm-hmm. And even often how we're going to analyze all those data that we get in the end. We have to have a really good idea of our space while also leaving ourselves open for surprises. Because if we're closed off to surprises, then we miss really what comes down to valuable information. And that's like getting into the nitty gritty of what uncertainty, what it means to work in uncertainty, and what it means to work in risk and risk analysis. You know, we have to understand that we don't have all the answers, but we still have to articulate how are we going to get there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think that's excellent. I mean, obviously a self-promotion to us, but that's any academic you bring into the private organizational, you know, space, is that's what you're bringing in. Somebody who has a mind of who can break down the process step by step. Mm-hmm. And see elements of the future that will help us right now in our efforts and not waste them, right? Yep, not make yep. wasted efforts.
Yeah. Okay. And kind of to that point of maybe it is self-promoting, but that's the value of academics, right? So you bring in academics, you work now as an organization, you bring in academics, we bring this kind of skeptical mindset, we bring this research mentality and say, okay, I'm not just going to go through the motions and deliver something to you. I also want to step back and say, what was the actual value of this work, right? How did it actually affect you? So that's why I always say, work with academics. Don't just go to a big consulting firm. No, come to us academics, and then you can get this kind of additional research panache, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a question at the end that I like to ask everybody in scenario planning and in the foresight field. We constantly are seeing things that we have at best come out in random conversations in pubs or at dinner or conferences, but we never really find a perch for them. And I would like to make this one of our perches. And my question is, in the field you're in and in the work you do and the everything that is your environment as the expert that you are and the research that you are, what trends are you seeing in your work, in your area of work that are happening right now or but just barely budding?
So right now, AI is such an overwhelming trend, right? So that is use of AI and really the uncertainty about how it's going to affect our work, both in terms of education, so how we teach, right? How we should incorporate AI, you know, lots of questions about that, but also in our research, how it is going to affect our research. I mean, should you use it for research design? I mean, there are so many things that AI can do. Sometimes it is scary that especially if you're working with secondary data, right? You don't need to spend several months gathering and analyzing the data. AI can do that like this, right? So that is definitely an overwhelming trend about use of AI. The second thing that I see, and that is more specific to my field of supply chain management, is the whole idea of dealing with uncertainty. in the long term, but also in the short term. So, for example, kind of related to scenario planning. So, if we kind of go back historically in like, kind of 1970s, 60s, even 1950s, the origins of scenario planning, the method it was created and evolved to make really long-term decisions, right? So, let's say we know that in the 1950s, at Rand Corporation, the use of scenario planning was to say, okay, what kind of defense infrastructure we need, right? So, really long-term decisions. Same with Shell, right? Really long-term decisions. And that's where the method has been really useful. But the question that I get in supply chain is that can we use the same approach for dealing with uncertainties in the short term? Because if I am dealing with let's say if I have to organize say, ocean carrier to carry several containers of goods that my factory in Asia is producing to its destination in, say, North America. And let's say that I need to book this in advance, say 2 months in advance. How should I know? How much capacity should I reserve? What carrier should I reserve? What rate should I reserve it at, right? What path should it take? Should it go through, say, the Suez Canal, or should it go around the, no, through the Pacific, right? So there are questions like that that are very short-term nature. We're thinking about uncertainties in next 3 to 6 months. And these things used to be more predictable. You can say, no, next 3 months are going to look fairly similar to what I've seen in the past. I can create a forecasting model based on historical data. Now, I can project it forward, say 3 months out. Simple exponential smoothing models. Now you combine them with machine learning and so on, work beautifully for the short-term kind of horizon. But even now, we are seeing massive uncertainties in that. So at least in supply chain management, that's a trend that we are seeing some kind of in maybe insoluble, I don't know if that's the right term, insoluble uncertainty, something that you cannot just say, next 3 months are going to look like what I've seen in last 3 months or no, historical data. So that is a trend definitely we see in supply chain management. Some unstructured uncertainties are also shaping the long short-term decision making.
It's pretty big, pretty weighty. But that's the point, right? That's some food for thought. What is the expert on the inside seeing that isn't really making it out to the general conversation yet? And this is what we do, isn't it? We are trend watchers. We are horizon scanners. We are red flag identifiers, if you will. Well, thank you, Shardul, for coming today. This has been fascinating. Like, I've read your chapter. I gave you feedback on your chapter. Your chapter's in a book together with us, and I still have learned an incredible amount of information from this. So I hope this really gets out in the field more. This is incredible stuff, and I will be in touch, by the way, about some future research, because without going into it any farther, I mean, that's all I do is research and then field work, right? And you've brought in some exceptional Venn diagramming kind of concepts that I'm excited to jump into further. So thank you. Thank you for coming
Fantastic.
today.
No, thank you. Thank you. It was really fun. Good.
Scenarios for Tomorrow is produced by me, Megan Crawford, with invaluable feedback from Dr. Isabel Ariza, Jeremy Creep, Brian Ego, and as always, my kids.
This is a production of the Futures and Analytics Research Hub and Far Lab, affiliated with Edinburgh Napier Business School. You can find show notes, references, and transcripts at scenarios.farhub.org. That's scenarios.farhub.org. You can follow us across social media by searching for Scenario Futures, all one word. You can subscribe to Scenarios for Tomorrow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Today's track was composed by Rocket, whose links are provided in the show notes. This is Scenarios for Tomorrow,
where tomorrow's headlines start as today's thought experiments.